its current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. The rest of the week, looking ahead briefly, is going to be interesting here on the show. We hope you can make it back tomorrow and Friday. Tomorrow, two prominent Republican lawmakers join us. Michigan House Speaker Jace Bolger joins us tomorrow. There are reports that the House could vote today on the Republican-backed measure to expand Medicaid in Michigan. So that is going to be a very timely visit from the House Speaker tomorrow. Also tomorrow, 7th Congressional Representative, U.S. Representative Tim Walberg leads the show. If you have questions that you'd like to suggest for those guests, any guests, if you have guests that you'd like to suggest, go for it. Current state at WKAR.org. Medicaid expansion, as we say, continues to be a very closely watched issue here in Michigan. Supporters, including our next guest, are encouraged by yesterday's move by a House committee to loosen requirements being discussed as part of an expansion. The impact of the Federal Affordable Care Act is tied closely to Medicaid expansion. Now, despite the legislative uncertainty, the 2014 Michigan budget did include funding for Michigan's county health plans, like the Ingham Health Plan, and we're joined now by Robin Reynolds, Executive Director of the Ingham Health Plan, to help us understand what all this means. Hi, Robin.
Hi.
At the beginning, I'd like to get your take on the changes made yesterday to, this is House Bill 4714, the Republican measure to expand Medicaid in Michigan. They dropped an earlier requirement that care be limited to 4 years for able-bodied adults. Any response to that change?
Well, I think that they needed to drop that because that was probably a showstopper for the federal waiver. They wouldn't, I'm sure, allow us to limit it to 48 months. They have replaced that, however, with some provisions that after the 48 months, if you're between 100 and 133% of the poverty level, that you would be, at the end of 48 months, you could get an exchange, go in on to the exchange and purchase insurance, or you could pay a 7% copay. So while they have dropped the absolute 48 months and you're off, they are giving some options to people after 48 months.
Did the limits there, did they have to go in your view, or could you have lived with it if it were the only way forward?
It would be pretty tough to live with a 48-month limit for everybody across the board. Able-bodied, what, you know, that would need to have more definition. I guess it's moving forward, so I could have lived with it and possibly worked with the legislature to understand the impact of that. However, I don't think the federal government would live with that.
Okay. Speaker Bolger's spokesman, Ari Adler, along with other Republicans, have said they want more personal responsibility for their own health from recipients. Any response to that?
I think everybody needs to take more personal responsibility for their health. That includes people who are on Medicaid, people who have Blue Cross Blue Shield. It is driving up the costs of care for everyone. I don't like the term skin in the game because I think people that are have less income or poorer already have skin in the game. They have poorer health outcomes, they die earlier, they have lower quality of life. So in a sense, they already have some skin in the game, so I don't like that term. But I think incentives and offering programs for everyone to become healthier is a good thing, and it'll lower overall health care costs.
You watch this thing pretty closely, I take it. Do you think a measure will go to the full House today? Do you watch it that closely to have a feeling that it will?
I think that it will.
Okay. Let's try to help our listeners understand how the legislature approached county health plans in Michigan, like the Ingham Health Plan. What did they do exactly with regard to funding here this just recently?
Well, in the original proposed budget for the governor, they eliminated the line item for county health plans because that would have Medicaid, if Medicaid was expanded, much of our population goes on Medicaid. However, with the thought that Medicaid might not pass, they have restored that funding from $24 million to $90 million, so they've completely restored the county health plan funding. Now, if this bill passes today and It still has to get through the Senate, which is
right.
also very delicate. And if it does go through and we have Medicaid expansion, they may pull that back out of county health plans. We're still waiting, and we'll talk to the department about that. My preference would be they would leave a little in there for some transition time. I don't think January 14, everybody's magically going to be covered. It's going to be a big job. So,
which would you prefer if you could only have one? I mean, the county funding or something similar to House Bill 4714?
I would prefer something similar to 4714.
Okay.
I want people covered.
So the state is, for now at least, the state is allocating money, federal money, for county health care plans. But if the expansion of Medicaid does not happen, what would the net impact be on your plan, the Ingham Health Plan? Is that more bad news than good news, or is it the other way around?
I think it's bad news if they don't pass 4714 or some Medicaid expansion in general. For us, what it would mean if they don't pass it and the money's in there, it's business as usual,
okay.
sort of. But we would probably concentrate on the people 0 to 100% of poverty, and those over 100% of poverty would be eligible for an exchange product, and we may be in a position to offer them some subsidy to help them afford what's on the exchange rather than offering the basic benefit. But we would still have the ability to cover those from 0 to 100% of federal poverty because they don't qualify for exchange products.
We're talking with Robin Reynolds, who's the executive director of the Ingham Health Plan. We're talking about Medicaid expansion and funding for her plan. Let's back up just a little bit and revisit the basics of the Ingham Health Plan. Who is it for? And what exactly does it offer?
The Ingham Health Plan is a basic benefit. It is not insurance. It's a benefit that's offered locally to individuals from 0 to 250% of poverty.
It's not insurance. It's actual
not.
Care.
It's,
is that what you're saying?
No, it's a benefit. We pay out like an insurance company, but
okay.
we're not licensed as insurance, and we don't have many of the same requirements as an insurer would. But we just offer a benefit to pay for outpatient care, specialty care, lab, radiology, and prescription meds. We don't cover any hospitalization or emergency room services. So it's a wellness benefit, if you will. It's to keep people healthy, keep them out of the emergency room, and keep them out of the hospital, control chronic diseases.
Dollar-wise, how big of a benefit does it offer?
I think we do a wonderful job. Our costs are about $40 per member per month, and we have approximately 11,000 members. So we provide a good benefit for $600 a year, and that's spread out because we have 11,000 people. Some are sicker, some are not as sick, and so.
But what's the biggest benefit you might pay out to somebody over the course of a year?
We may pay $5,000.
Okay.
Labs, lab radiology tends to be very expensive. But.
And Ingham has a plan. This is a plan that really surpasses a lot of other county plans in terms of quality, correct?
Well, as the president of the State Association, I don't know if I want to say that it surpasses all of the health plans. It was the first health plan that was developed, and many of the other health plans in the state are designed after the Ingham Health Plan.
That's what I've been led to
yep.
believe in the past. So.
And many of the other county health plans do operate similarly. We have a larger population. We go up to 250% of poverty. Most plans only go up to 150%.
How many people could you reach with this offering that you're not reaching right now?
Well, there's 30,000 uninsured. We cover approximately 11. That's total. So we probably cover half of the people that would qualify based on their income up to 250% of poverty. We probably cover about 70% of those eligible.
70%.
Yeah.
Okay. What medical issues, just go a little bit deeper with me here, what medical issues does it help people with most often? What do you see, what does your benefit go toward?
It goes toward primary office visits, establishing with a primary care physician, a medical home, and also managing chronic diseases. So diabetes, asthma, hypertension. We have an organized system of care where people can get lab tests and get and monitor their condition. They're connected with a primary care physician that can follow them. So we do have a lot of folks that we try to manage chronic disease.
But the focus is on prevention. Mm-hmm. Can you safely say that?
Yep. It is very much on prevention, and we work closely with the hospitals, and our goal is to keep people out of the hospital and keep them healthy and connected to a primary medical home.
You mentioned being the president of a statewide association, which I didn't realize. What is the association again?
It is the Michigan County Health Plan Association.
Okay. And are the issues that your association deals with basically the same as the issues that you deal with here in Ingham County, or is there some kind of variation across the state?
They're primarily the same issues. Okay. We come together to deal with them as a group.
Okay. Now, whether Michigan approves Medicaid expansion or not, federal funding for county health plans will begin to go away next year as part of the Affordable Care Act. Is the Ingham Health Plan subject to federal funding cuts next year as part of Obamacare?
Part of the reduction that was in the governor's budget reflected what the state thought the feds were going to reduce this year.
Right.
And they put $70 million reduction, but the reduction was only $20 million. So the reduction was less than anticipated for Michigan. That continues to be reduced every year, and quite substantially towards 2017, they want to eliminate our funding and a lot of the DSH funds, the money that is directed toward hospitals to pay for uncompensated care. The theory being that if people are covered under Medicaid, there will be less uncompensated care.
Gotcha. We've been talking with Robin Reynolds, who is executive director of the Ingham Health Plan. We'll all be watching what goes on in the Michigan House closely here today. Robin, yes. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Michigan was one of the fastest growing states for wind power in 2012, according to the American Wind Energy Association's annual market report. But wind power is a complicated issue, and joining us now to talk about it is Jim Dalzo of the Michigan Land Use Institute in Traverse City. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
We are well here in East Lansing, and you are well in Traverse City, I presume.
Yeah, it's a little foggy around the edges,
okay.
It'll be a nice day.
Wind energy has seen its ups and downs in various parts of the state. Talk to us a little bit about the challenges faced by proponents of wind power here in Michigan.
Well, I think the biggest challenge proponents of wind power face is getting out all the good news about wind. It works very well. It's cheap. It is very clean. It doesn't hurt anybody. And I think the more that people understand that, the better it will be for wind power and for our energy systems and the price of electricity in Michigan.
Tax policy apparently has an impact on the debate over wind power. Tell us how.
Well, it depends which tax you're talking about. There is a personal property tax when a wind turbine goes up, and the local government, township and county, collect property taxes due to that. So it's a real good thing for local tax revenues. There's also a production tax credit on wind that has been very on and off over the last 20 years, which has reduced its effectiveness in terms of companies being able to plan their budgets. But it actually still has worked pretty well despite all that. The point of the production credit tax is to encourage more wind development, allowing the wind industry to scale up and innovate on its technology and, reap the harvest of larger production scale. And that has happened. And I was thinking about this last night, 5 or 6 or maybe 8 years ago, we were real thrilled to hear that a wind farm near us here in McBain, Michigan, was selling wind for 11 cents a kilowatt hour. That seemed like, wow, that's just a breakthrough price. Well, I looked the other day, and Detroit Edison's latest wind farm, which is going up, will be around 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour. Wind power has gotten extremely cheap because it has scaled up and it has been able to innovate and it has been able to just generally improve the whole technology and the industry's efficiency.
You mentioned earlier that wind power does not hurt anybody, but NPR reported recently on some research regarding the effects of low-frequency noise from wind turbines. Some people living nearby report symptoms such as dizziness, trouble sleeping, ear pain, and on and on. One researcher who co-authored a review article of a study about this said, "We think infrasound causes problems in the inner ear, and we think wind turbines produce infrasound, but we can't stand up and put our hands on our hearts and say wind turbines cause wind turbine syndrome." Could you comment on these folks who believe they're suffering from being close to these turbines?
You know, that's a real big ball of wax there. I am quite convinced that, I'll tell you this. I wrote an article about infrasound 3 years ago. I've been very, very aware of the claims about infrasound. They really are without scientific merit. Infrasound is very, very hard to measure. The thing to understand first about infrasound is that it's everywhere. The Great Lakes make infrasound. Jets flying overhead make infrasound. When you're in your car, excuse me, you are exposed to infrasound. If you walk by a spinning washing machine, you're exposed to infrasound.
But isn't it conceivable that someone next to a wind farm might be more exposed to that?
Well, that's very, very hard to prove, because when the wind blows, the turbine turns, but the wind goes through the forests or across the trees or along the fields and also makes infrasound. Infrasound is very difficult to measure, and the best research I've seen on it says that wind turbines give off relatively little infrasound. There have been some very interesting studies lately, because this has become such a question, about showing people the nocebo effect with infrasound. If they took large groups of people, showed them a film explaining the dangers of infrasound, split them in half, actually exposed one group to infrasound, did not expose the other group to infrasound, but they were both told that they had just were exposed to infrasound, and sure enough, both groups had symptoms, claimed symptoms. When the reverse of that was done, and infrasound was said to be completely harmless, and now we're going to expose these two different groups, they thought it was harmless. I think that there's a certain, I don't know really what the word is, there's certainly a psychology about this that applies. A lot of the studies that we've seen from Europe, where a lot of people live next to a lot of wind farms, seem to indicate that if people are involved in the project in a monetary way, in fact, if they're getting rewarded for being living near a wind farm, they really don't see any of these kinds of symptoms. And a study in Australia that's about 4 months old now looked at every wind farm in Australia. The only ones where they could find complaints about infrasound were the ones where proponents had gone in and warned people that if this is being built, you're going to suffer from infrasound. I think the thing is a chimera. I think it's a very natural reaction by some people who don't like wind farms to find a way, perhaps subconsciously, to feel bad about it. But
okay.
I just don't see that as a real issue, personally.
We're talking with Jim Dalzo of the Michigan Land Use Institute up in Traverse City about wind farms and wind power in Michigan. So far, most of the wind turbines that have actually been built in the state have been on land. Some northern Michigan lawmakers up in your neck of the woods have introduced legislation that would stop any proposed research or production of offshore wind power in the Great Lakes that border Michigan. The proposed offshore wind farms at Cape Cod in Massachusetts were a big controversy. Even the late Edward Kennedy came out against them. Describe the differences between the kind of opposition we see for offshore turbines and what we've seen inland.
I think they're both equally fatuous. They're based on stuff that's not really science. They're based on claims and anecdotal evidence. There's really no evidence to speak against wind farms on the lake other than people saying, hey, I don't like looking at wind farms out on my lake. And I totally understand that objection, and that needs to be dealt with in some ways. There needs to be some discussion about how important is somebody's view versus the good things that can come from wind power. But these legislators up here, that's really some goofy stuff. I mean, they're saying Greg McMaster is one of these two guys, one of these two representatives, said he's all for wind power, but he doesn't think it'll work on the lakes because it gets too cold and it'll wreck the turbines. Well, how does he know that? And then he turns around and proposes a bill that forbids research on it? I mean, draw your own conclusions.
In Benzie County, the northern Lower Peninsula, some residents are fighting proposed wind farms by requesting permits for helipads, up to 8 of them. There are 5, I believe, here in Lansing and East Lansing. Heliports could prevent construction of wind turbines or any structure taller than 200 feet within almost a one-mile radius. Is this kind of strategy something that you foresee other people following? If you don't want wind power, get helipads?
Well, I mean, that remains to be tested in court someday going down the road. I don't really know if that can work or not. I mean, we were kind of amazed when we saw that. The wind proposal in Benzie is pretty much dead. I mean, Duke Energy withdrew from that almost 2 years ago, and a year later, they passed this crazy helipad thing. I mean, that kind of says it all. People would rather have helicopters buzzing over their house than think that they're living somewhere near a wind turbine, really?
It seems to be a really polarizing thing. The people who dislike it call it a boondoggle. People believe in it like yourself, see it as a win-win for business and the environment, something that Michigan can actually do, unlike solar. Do you think it will eventually be accepted or rejected by the people of Michigan?
Well, I think you'll see it unfold in a community by community basis. There are communities that are very, very happy with their wind farms, both in Michigan and all around the country and all around the world. The stuff that's being put out against wind power, I think, has a lot to do with the kind of stuff that's being put out about climate change by certain vested interests who have a great concern that if enough people take this seriously, it's going to hurt their little coal business, or it's going to hurt their oil business, or it's going to hurt their extraction industry business. And there was still is a very organized attempt at climate denial, and I think we're seeing that going on with wind power denial. It's the same tactics, it's coming from the same sources, and it's pretty clear to us what's going on. It's whether people want to be misled or not.
We've been talking about wind power in Michigan with Jim Dalzo of the Michigan Land Use Institute in Traverse City. Thank you, Jim.
Oh, thanks, Mark. See you later.
Another growing season has arrived in Michigan. Farmers and gardeners all over the state are in high gear. WKAR's Peter Worf struck out recently to one of the Lansing area's better-known farm stands. He spoke with MSU student organic farm stand manager April Planke about campus organic farming and the weekly campus bounty.
Well, I think that especially with our society today and the trends toward processed foods and different diseases and problems we're having, kids are very disoriented. People, not just kids, are very disoriented from where their food comes from, what health is, and what's good for them and what's not good for them. So teaching people, connecting people back to the land, back to where food is grown, where it comes from, what is healthy for you is just a huge life goal of mine.
So tell me, what kind of work do you do? What sort of what sort of jobs do you have? What are the things that you do day to day in association with the farm?
A lot of my job revolves around the training program, the students we have. So there's the farm that we have to maintain and function, and then there's our students that are there to study. And so it's a balance between taking care of the farm and teaching our students how to help us take care of the farm. So I kind of just run through the week. On Mondays, we do a farm walk with the students where we walk around the farm, assess things that need to be done, point things out to the students like that they may learn from, different pests, different ways of planting things to teach them hands-on. And then we go through the week, Tuesday, Wednesday, doing farm work. The students have lectures that we teach them. I'm on a staff of six that we all do that. And then we have the farm that we're planting things, we're maintaining things, and the students get put in charge of different spaces to maintain, and then we're basically there to guide them and then allow them to, form their own freedom and manage their spaces at the farm.
How do you enjoy working with the students?
I really enjoy it. When I went into this, I really thought that I would want to be part of teaching for my career. And I found that I really, really enjoy it. I just love teaching people, especially something I'm passionate about growing food. I think it's great. It's very rewarding. The students are very receptive, and they're positive. They're all great people out there, and I really enjoy it.
This is an all-student-run farm?
I wouldn't say no, not all-student. We have six staff members, and then we have 6 to 8 crew, which are hired. They're actually students here at MSU getting their undergraduates. And so they work with us part-time, whatever their hours allow. And then there are 16 training students we're at the farm full-time, although some of the portion of that is lectures and training, and then the other portion is them actually engaging in the spaces and working and growing the food themselves.
Where are your students from?
The majority of them are from Michigan, but all around parts of Michigan. But we do have several students that came from out of state, from Georgia, Florida, so all around the U.S., but a lot of them are from Michigan area.
Tell me about the stand that's right here at on farm and auditorium.
So the farm stand is, we have it every Thursday from 11 to 5:30 from April to October, and we come here, we bring all our fresh produce we have. Right now we have a lot of transplants, and we're excited to be here and hoping to have a good day even though it's raining.
Well, maybe you can hear the rain on top of the pop-up tent today. We actually could use a little rain right now.
Yes,
it hasn't rained
in
a few days.
Yes, very true.
April Planke is the student manager of the Student Organic Farm Stand. We're right here on Farm Lane. What do you think are the most important things for people to know about organic farming?
Well, I think that a lot of people are immediately sort of opposed to it because it seems like you can't grow food organically, but you can, and it is actually the way that they grew food for hundreds and thousands of years before, the conventional farming system began. But to me and to many of our students, the most important part about it is that there's no artificial chemicals or, potentially toxic chemicals that are used in organic farming, so we consider it safer and healthier for us to consume. And I realize that not everybody is convinced, but not just for ourselves, but also for the environment. A lot of these chemicals are being shown to have some very negative effects on you know, water systems and different other parts of the environment. So I would say that the disuse of the chemicals is vastly important.
April, what do you put sort of nearer the top of the list of things that I want to eat that are organic versus those that aren't grown organically?
I would say...
My top choices.
Top choices. Mm. Any of the greens, if you're eating the green portion of the plant, I think that that's probably the most important to be organic, because that green part of the plant is the part that's going to be making the contact with those chemicals that you're potentially taking in if it's grown conventionally.
Tell me more about what you have here today.
So we have lots of greens. We have lettuces, different salad mixes that are a little more bold in flavor, like the arugula and the brassica salad mix. We have a lot of transplants for sale, which I'm really excited about this year, amping those up. We have a lot of different herb transplants. There's flower transplants. Warm season crops people are really excited about are the tomatoes and basil. Kale rabe, that's a really exciting one that people aren't very familiar with. It's actually the flower of kale, which tastes very much like broccoli. It's one of my favorites.
I love it. It looks almost like a Chinese broccoli.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It's delicious.
Yeah, it's good. April, what will we be looking for in the coming weeks and as we get into, you know, summer, mid-June, and then what can we look forward to, say, in the next month or so that'll be coming up?
Well, we at the farm are very, very excited about the tomatoes that are planted in the tunnels. They're just starting to form fruit now. So we'll have tomatoes and peppers. Later in the season, we'll have things like watermelons, strawberries, raspberries, lots of good stuff coming up.
April Planky is the farm stand manager of the Student Organic Farm here at Michigan State University. April, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It's Wednesday, and it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature Black Men Incorporated of Greater Lansing, which for nearly 20 years has been mentoring black youth in the Lansing area. And here to tell us more about Black Men Incorporated is Board President Greg Kelly. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm real good. Glad to have you here. And member Fred Porter. Hi, Fred.
Hi.
Glad you're both here. Tell us, Greg, how Black Men Incorporated of Greater Lansing got started. You're about 20 years old?
Yeah, we're 20 years old, and we started with Four Penn. Dr. Lang, who was an MSU professor at the time, Dr. Turpin, who was a dentist. He still is in the area, but he's retired now. Lee Richardson, who's passed, but he was a member of the Lansing School District Adult Ed Program.
All right.
And then Earl Nelson. Earl Nelson was a vocal instructor.
Sure.
And Earl Nelson became a state representative, and then Earl Nelson became a state senator, and then Earl Nelson founded the Earl Nelson Singers.
That's right.
And they just celebrated their 50th anniversary a couple weeks ago.
We did a segment on it on the show.
Okay.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, yes, he was one of the founders. And the reason why the organization was founded, because the community needed an independent organization that wasn't affiliated with any other group, but had the heart and mind for the kids. And we say it's all about the kids.
Okay.
In most of everything we do. And we try to impact them in a way that other institutions and organizations aren't capable of doing.
What is it you provide them that isn't being provided?
We provide them an intrinsic opportunity to grow. For instance, when we do our, and one of our late members came up with the Take a Kid Shopping program.
Okay.
That grew out of what he saw as a need for those kids who didn't have fathers in the house. It's Christmas time, and they were hurting. And so we started with, I think it was 20 of them, and we only had like maybe $20 to give them and let them shop for their mothers.
I see. Okay.
And because kids are selfish. Okay, and they like to always do something for themselves.
So you're instilling them the idea that you got to get your mother a gift.
You got to give
Christmas.
That's right.
A good thing.
That's a very good thing.
Yeah.
Because when I was taking the kids out shopping. One of the things I noticed recently is that with the electronic games, that's the first thing they after.
Yeah.
No. But they're not old enough to buy the games.
Yeah. Well, maybe mom would like an electronic game.
Well, the clerk's not going to sell it to
them. A lot of mothers ended up with electronic games when you started this.
No, you got to be 17. So we let the store tell them that they can't have that. Then we turn around because part of the criteria that we have is that they know their mother's favorite color, what type of thing she likes. Like some mothers like Coca-Cola symbols or, you know, Betty Bop or something. Well, they have to know that.
Okay.
And so we turn them around and say, okay, you need to buy for your mother first.
Get to know your mother well enough that you can buy her a gift she would like.
Right, right, and her favorite color.
That can be a challenge.
Yeah, you got to ask.
Fred, tell us how you're involved in this group. What do you do?
Well, I got started originally when the group first approached individuals to see if they're interested in helping. I've been involved in the community most of my life in different organizations. I was more than happy to join and participate. So I'm just one of the workers, so to speak.
One of the cogs in the machinery here, is that it?
One of the major things that the Black Men Sponsors is an organization I've been involved with. It's called the Lansing Black College Tour. We take youngsters to visit historical black colleges every year.
Okay.
Basically, we want youngsters to know about their history and why we have historical black colleges. Because when I was a youngster, I couldn't go to Duke or to Alabama State, Alabama A&M. I could go to, but not Alabama, University of Alabama.
Right.
So we take youngsters to see these schools, and we think it's a kind of a history lesson. We've been fairly successful in getting youngsters to even apply to some of these schools.
What's the reaction of the kids who see these schools?
Well, for most of them, it's something they haven't seen in the past, to see administrators and presidents and many teachers who look like them. It makes a big, big difference.
Do many of them end up attending one of them? Can you say that one of them that you've taken has actually attended?
Well, actually, last year we had 7 youngsters accepted at Bethune-Cookman. It's unusual for them to be accepted on the spot, but usually they will apply. And
7 in 1 year?
7 out of our group. They usually will apply, and they let you apply for free on the tour. But these youngsters got accepted by the president, a letter from the president on the spot, after reviewing their application. It was very unusual. 6 of them were from Everett and 1 from Sexton.
My daughter, who went on the tour about maybe 6 years ago, decided that she was going to go to Spelman College as opposed to Penn State.
Okay.
And she was a cheerleader at J.W. Sexton, and she continued her cheer all 4 years through school, and she went out to University of Arizona for her graduate study. So she's back now. In fact, she sent me a message to call her after I get off the air with you. But she's extremely proud of that opportunity. But she wouldn't have had it unless she went.
Have you been doing that for 20 years, or is this?
This will be our 22nd year.
22nd year you've been taking kids to the black colleges.
Yes.
How about that?
Yeah, but see, that's what's unique about our organization is that there are different components that were Fred's independent of us. We support him, but we don't run his program.
Okay.
And there are other programs like that when we do our Salute to Excellence. Now, that's one of our programs, but our committee runs that.
We're talking with Fred Porter and Greg Kelly about their organization, Black Men Incorporated of Greater Lansing. Let's talk about that Salute to Excellence mentoring program. Are you involved in that, Fred?
I am, but it's run by our president. I'm just one of the workers.
Okay. Well, tell us about it, Mr.
What
president.
What it is that we are saluting behaviors and academics. If you bring a pencil to class, if you show up on time, if you stop taking people's lunch money, if you pay attention to detail, the staff notices your change in behavior. So we ask the school staff to identify those kids who have now turned themselves around because we want to honor them, because with kids, attention's attention. It could be negative or it can be positive. So we're saluting the positive attention with the kids who normally get ignored because they're below the 2.5 average, but they're bringing themselves up. So we invite them and their mothers and their family members to a breakfast where we honor them for their change in behavior. We give them a certificate that acknowledges that. We have the school principal or counselor come and give it to them and say a little something about them. We have a guest speaker come in who was Professor Thomas from LCC, who gave us a tremendous speech about showing up. Can't do anything unless you show up.
Half of life is showing up.
That's right. Absolutely. But see, that's a positive message.
Yeah.
Then we take a picture of them with their parent, a picture of them with their classmates, and we give that to them so that moment is now, you know, be part of it. When they graduate from high school, they'll see it again.
Fred Porter, are there any stories that stick out in your mind that really illustrate why you're a part of this group?
Well, the main thing that makes me want to be a participant is the lack of young African-American males who graduate from high school. The numbers are declining. One of the things that we try to target are young African-American males, let them know how important it is for them to get an education. Because without education, as we keep telling them, you are doomed to failure. You can't make it in this society without something to offer society. You got to be a plumber or electrician or have a degree to offer society, or they don't need you. And it's very difficult to get that across to some of these youngsters.
Fred,
all of them think they're going to be a pro football player, pro basketball player, or a rapper, and it's not going to happen.
Have you stayed in touch with any of the kids that you've mentored over the years?
Fortunately, many of them remember me. Unfortunately, I can't remember them. I have a little system that I usually go by. I tell them, I remember your face, I just can't remember your name.
Yeah, I dust off that line on a regular basis. So, where does your funding come from, Greg?
We have a major fundraiser in the spring. It's called our, what's it called?
The fundraiser?
Yeah.
Where I don't know if we have an official name. We go to the gambling casino at Trippers.
Okay.
And we participate in that. That's one of our major fundraisers to operate that program. I think it's 2 or 3 days a week that we...
Yeah, but our dinner dance is Saving a Generation.
Okay, we do.
Yeah, that's just the one where we ask the other people in the community to attend our function, and they buy a ticket. And we usually, you know, use that money to generate for our other programs.
Okay.
And like, for instance, it's not just the kids either. We had a heck of a prostate cancer drive a few years ago. It was so successful between us, at that time, Ingham Medical and St. Stephen's Church, that for a few years they said that kind of cooled it, because we were bringing in like 500 or 600 guys.
Interesting. We're just about out of time. How can people become a member and get behind the cause?
Well, you just have to be able to adhere to what we talk about in terms of we're always seeking new members who have the interests of the community and the kids at heart.
And are you online, though? Or is...
Yes, we are. Okay. In fact, we are at...
You get it on there somewhere.
We're about to hear the website.
Oh, yeah, www.bmigl.org.
BMIGL.org. Greg Kelly is board president of Black Men Incorporated of Greater Lansing. Fred Porter is a member. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Built by the legendary French explorer René Robert Sieur de La Salle, the Griffin may have been the first vessel ever to sail on the Great Lakes. The ship disappeared in 1679 after setting sail from near present-day Green Bay, Wisconsin. Now, after years of research and exploration, an organization called the Great Lakes Exploration Group discovered what it thinks is the bow of the Griffin in Lake Michigan. Recently, the organization received permission from state officials to conduct a test excavation to learn more. Joining us today is Ken Vrana, project manager for the Center of Maritime and Underwater Resource Management, which is in charge of archaeological assessment of the site. Mr. Vrana has 35 years of experience in underwater research with the National Park Service, Michigan State University, and others. Ken, welcome to Current State.
Pleased to join you this morning.
On the Great Lakes Exploration Group's website, it says that the Griffin was, and I'll quote here, the first European-owned vessel to sail the upper Great Lakes. Can you tell us a little bit more about that story? I know it disappeared way back, 1679.
Sure, and let's make a distinction here. At that time, the upper Great Lakes were the lakes beyond Niagara Falls, which, of course, posed a barrier to navigation. So there were vessels built prior to Le Griffin by Europeans on Lake Ontario, but we believe that Le Griffin was the first decked European vessel to sail beyond Lake Ontario onto the Upper Great Lakes in 1679.
Yeah. Were you a part of the team that made this discovery?
Well, let's caution you. No, I'm a scientist, and the object of the test excavations is actually to positively identify this site. We have done years of remote sensing and carbon dating of an exposed wooden feature, but what we call Site 20, UM723, has not been positively identified. I mean, that's the purpose of this expedition.
Okay. So it's too early for you to wager any bets as to whether or not this actually may be the Griffin.
Right. But it sure has the makings of a great detective novel with all these modern forensic techniques we have available to solve what could be an over 350-year-old maritime mystery that has captivated people in the Great Lakes region for generations.
Well, it begs the question, if it's not the Griffin, what the heck is it? You know, it seems you've discovered something.
Yeah, what we know right now, based on current findings, and these are the remote sensing findings using mainly acoustic tools, sound waves that can actually penetrate the sediment and or produce pictures of the surface of the lake bed.
Okay.
But those findings are consistent with a buried shipwreck. And the exposed wooden timber at the site is consistent with the construction of a vessel of early build. So as you can see, the process of archaeology is building the evidence needed to make decisions. And all the evidence so far tests or basically points to the need for test excavations to now finally determine the identity of this site.
What sort of timetable are you on, Ken?
We will begin the work this summer, fairly soon, and it's bringing together Michigan professionals from many different walks of life, archaeologists, commercial divers with Great Lakes Diving and Salvage of Waters, Michigan, the folks with Great Lakes Exploration Group. And then, of course, there's a number of state and federal agencies that have been extremely supportive in terms of reviewing our archaeological research designs and plans, and based on that, granting all the permits that are required to do the type of excavation work that is contemplated at the site.
Do you expect an ID, an identification of what's there before the end of the summer then?
Absolutely. And I wanted to point out why, you know, Le Griffin is in the news as a potential of this for this site, is that so far we don't have any evidence that eliminates Le Griffin. So that's another part of the scientific process in terms of the questions we ask in terms of archaeology in making decisions. So it is quite an exciting event.
How deep is what you found?
We can't disclose either the location or the depth, but it is within working depth of divers, scientific and commercial divers.
And how late into the season can you work, or do you expect to be able to work?
that depends on what the site ends up being identified as. If indeed this is Le Griffin, that would trigger a major archaeological excavation.
You're saying that you can work, divers can actually work on this excavation, but tell us about the most cutting-edge piece of equipment that you've got in your arsenal.
Well, I'd like to point out the use of sub-bottom profilers. This is a device that uses low-frequency sound waves that can actually penetrate the lake bottom, the sediments and substrate, and even underlying geological features. And that's critical in underwater archaeology when you do have the potential of a buried site. In this way, you can image and get a good idea what is underneath before you conduct any intrusive or potentially damaging activities.
Fascinating. Ken Varana is project manager for the Center of Maritime and Underwater Resource Management. We've been talking about what lies beneath a part of Lake Michigan. It may be the Griffin. We'll find out soon enough. Ken, thank you.
My pleasure, and we do plan to post some information and pictures on the WKAR website during the continuing investigation.
We're very happy about that. Thank you, Ken.
My pleasure.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, a couple of prominent Republicans. We talk with Michigan Speaker of the House Jace Bolger, along with 7th District U.S. Congressman Tim Walberg. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer, thanks to Aaron Young for engineering, Becky McHenry for production assistance, and Kim Geiger for her IT expertise. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.